So now do we sing? Is that what happens here? Like,
I hope not. I don't think anyone would enjoy that from my end. Over I don't know how your voice is, but mine isn't a great singing voice.
No, and no one needs that on Christmas. Over the river and through the woods, right?
Exactly.
To grandmother's house we go.
And if we're going through the woods, it's a good time to look for stuff.
Hey, see?
And we have a very special episode this week from one of my favorite naturalists, Sam Gaida. Now, Heidi, you knew Sam first, right?
Well, I wouldn't say I knew him, but I heard him, his little voice.
How little?
When he would have been in middle school, and he was part of Ken Perry's natural or phenology club that met, you know, just an extra activity. It wasn't even a class, you know? And that was one of the first, I think, if we asked John Latimer, I think Virginia might have been the first school. Have you ever heard what that might be?
Okay.
Virginia or Crosby?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
I think maybe Crosby. There was a teacher in Crosby.
Crosby?
Okay. Yeah. This is the Season Watch podcast. It is our special holiday edition. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Charlie Mitchell.
And we're excited to be here. We're bringing you in the next couple of weeks some of our favorite things of the year. And one of our big favorite things is when we have heard from people. I mean, we would love to, you know, sometimes the holidays, you need to get outside a little bit, even if it's really cold, to look around. So it'd be a great time to just send us a little note through SpeakPipe, what you see on Christmas and Christmas weekend, you know?
Absolutely. And also, if you have any, like, fun nature audio, send it our way, too. You know, we have those little clips at the end and the beginning of the podcast, and we'd love to use yours if you come across something fun.
Yeah.
Send it our way.
Well, let's get back to Sam Gaida. It's not the first time we've mentioned him on the Season Watch pod, because I definitely remember telling you the story of the alien gull that I found the first time I even knew what a gull was. But as Charlie said, Sam was a young kid who got interested in phenology. His voice was on KEXE. And not that we are completely responsible. Sounds like he's got parents who really pushed him as well. But he's one of the many people we're proud of that is breaking new paths in science.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, he's all grown up now, to say the least. And he's been working at Wolf Ridge as a naturalist there for a number of years, and is discovering new species and organizing people on iNaturalist and finding all sorts of cool, undiscovered, overlooked stuff in the forest out in the world. And I like that's such a great example of the influence of just being curious and the difference that one person being curious and following that curiosity can make. I love seeing that through line from John Latimer and his passion inspiring people, and then seeing Sam come along and his passion, I mean, discovering new species, inspiring more people. It's wonderful.
We're going to listen to the full conversation that was on our morning show. We didn't have time to ask him so many questions. And so, Charlie, you and I want to have him back and kind of pick his brain for this Season Watch pod. But one thing I was sort of, I was thinking of you when he was describing how iNaturalist is making such a huge difference in this. And like his story of he posted a gull that he couldn't connect to anything, didn't know what it was. And then he's like, 2 years later, someone saw it, you know, like, wow, the patience, the drama, the answers that he gets. And then so people getting involved through iNaturalist. And I know that's something you like to use as well.
Absolutely. And iNaturalist, I can tell you his iNaturalist account off the top of my head, not because we correspond a lot on iNaturalist, but because I'm always looking for local photos to use in the newsletter. And his account always pops up with like the perfect picture that I need for this thing. And he's certainly been the person who has identified a few gulls for me. And I love iNaturalist, and I love that it like makes these little digital connections that all of a sudden become real life ones.
We didn't even get a chance to, like I said, that there were so many more questions that I had, and I had to kind of butt in at the end, I wanted to kind of lay out how he's connected to us. But he has written a new book that he's published. It's on your list of Christmas gifts. You've got at least two for people, right?
I got three copies.
So it's
one for me.
Galls, Burls, and Brooms. We didn't even touch on what the heck a broom is.
So a broom, if you think about, this is one of my favorite John Latimer quotes. Now, this is a mistletoe, but it's not the one you've been standing under and getting kissed. So mistletoe, it's a kind of fungus that infects, I think there's spruces or maybe firs, one of the evergreens that's not a pine. And it forms this, like, it looks kind of like a witch's broom, really thick cluster of twigs that doesn't follow the regular growth pattern of the tree. And it's not the fungus that's forming these twigs. The fungus affects the plant cells in a way that they grow to form. It's the broom is made out of plant, not out of fungus.
One thing he said in that interview that I just loved, he said he was talking really fast and he just said something about his study of stuff on stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
It's perfect. That's exactly what it is.
Is any of it bad? Is it harmful to anything, to the stuff that grows on stuff?
The stuff that grows on stuff? Some of the stuff that grows on stuff is harmful. For instance, there's a fungus that impacts, I think, apple fruit trees. Mm. And this fungus goes through two hosts. So sometimes in the spring, I will see these, I think they're juniper trees, with these weird, almost like gelatinous looking orange growths on them. And this fungus spends part of its life cycle on junipers and then spends part of its life cycle on apple trees. And it does impact the crop. So yeah, like any large group of organisms, in this case, they're insects, fungus, you know, a lot of different things. Some of them are harmful, some of them beneficial. And it all depends on who you're asking.
Well, and I don't know that we've yet described here, you'll get to hear it in this interview with Sam Gaida, what exactly a gall is, what we're talking about here, and why we're so fascinated by it. But we thought this was a great Christmas present to the curious, or it's going to spark something in someone driving in a car over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house they're going, and they're going to learn about galls. Charlie,
enjoy.
Charlie, I want to take this moment to say thank you. This has been just a pleasure. We're so excited for the year ahead of more Season Watch pods.
This has been an absolute delight. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Here's Sam Gaida from the KAXE Morning Show. It is Tuesday morning on KAXE. We dive deep into natural resource-based issues important to our region. And today we're exploring a part of nature that most of us walk by without noticing. Galls, burls, and brooms. Our guest is naturalist Sam Gaida to talk about these unique natural features and his recently published field guide, Galls, Burls, and Brooms of the North Woods. Sam, welcome back.
Hey, good to see you, man.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, we love having you, man. If you lived here in the neighborhood, I'd probably have you on monthly just to tell me what it is I'm looking at. And speaking of that, we had a couple of notes this morning. One, I noted the galls on the black ash that during our bird count, you know, it's like, whoa, what's that over there? Is that a flock of birds in that tree? And then, you know, close examination, no, that's not birds. And then someone else mentioned one of the kids in their reports talked about two things, really. One, the pinecone gall on the willows, and the second one was black knot fungus. And I don't know if you cover black knot fungus in your group, but so how did it all start? And then maybe you can branch out and tell us a little bit more about the black ash and some other interesting things out there.
Perfect. So I initially got into it. Well, growing up, you know, I grew up on a small farm near Nisswa, Minnesota, and spent a lot of time outdoors with my parents and grandpa. And the first memories I have of gulls is wandering around with grandpa and finding the goldenrod gulls. Especially in winter, we'd slice them open and you'd find that tiny little grub inside, which, you know, as a kid was mind blowing to have an insect be around in the winter and still see it alive and moving. And, you know, they popped up every once in a while where, like, at one point there were a whole bunch of acorn plum gulls that would fall underneath the oaks, and grandpa didn't want the cows eating them. And so we stopped and we'd pick them up every day. And, you know, they were just kind of like a novel curiosity. And then I kind of forgot about them, and I got pretty into plants and got to be a pretty solid botanist. And then when I was living up at Wolf Ridge and working as a naturalist up there, kind of ran out of plants to look at one winter because there were about 3 feet of snow, and I was looking at, you know, smashed hazel and more smashed hazel, and every once in a while, you know, all of the other North Shore trees like balsam fir and a couple balsam poplars, but I'd really run out of stuff to find. And then one way, while walking down the driveway, I came across a very similar gull to those kids who wrote in, of a funky little thing growing on a willow. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I wonder what that is. I've got nothing else to look at on plants. I might as well bring this back. And I cut it open, and it turned out to be a tiny little creature with a huge name of the willow-beaked gull midge. And pretty soon, I was wandering down the driveway again, and I came across that exact one that the kids found of the willow pinecone gull midge. And I stopped, and I looked at it, and I went, this is a deciduous tree. There aren't supposed to be pine cones on it. What is this? And again, cut it open, and there wasn't anything inside that one, but I could see a tiny chamber where something had lived. And again, after a little bit more Googling, it turned out to be the willow pinecone gull midge. And at that point, I was hooked. And, you know, I started to fall deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole of gulls. But something that I really struggled with as a naturalist as I got going is there weren't really any resources for me. I read a ton of scientific papers, and, you know, I was going through Dichotomous Keys, and if I wanted to find any of the guides, most of them were out of print, and the most recent one that generally covered North American midges was printed in the 80s, and so it was relatively old and really difficult to find, and a couple $100, and as a starting naturalist, that just wasn't something I could afford, and it wasn't super accessible, and so as I got into gulls, I, you know, kept being like, oh, someone should do a field guide. Someone should do a field guide. And then chatting with Joe up at Wolf Ridge, at one point he was like, you know, you could do the field guide. And at that point I was like, ooh, that'd be cool. But, you know, it was quite the learning process. And this summer finally self-published a field guide. And it's been really fun to go around and do programs ever since. But like you mentioned, my goals kind of switch for which ones I focus on throughout the year, because you see all sorts of leaf gulls in the summer. And then, you know, in the fall, you start to transition. And in the winter, I call the gulls that I find more of the birding gulls, or, you know, the gulls at 70 miles an hour, because you're driving down the highway and all of a sudden you go, oh, what was that? And very similar to the ones that you were talking about on the black ash. You're like, oh, that stands out because there are no leaves. I can't see anything else, but there is something there. And so, you know, it's been fun to dive into those and really help people start looking around them in a different way.
Tell us a little bit about the black ash gull, the one that's prominent and common and easily seen this time of year. What is it? How does it get going? How come we can see it? Are they female seeds? You know, there were some speculation over the internet this morning about it. So tell us a little bit about that one to start with. I have more.
Yeah. And that's one of the first ones I got into as well, because up on the North Shore, there are tons of black ashes. And, you know, the further north you go in Minnesota, especially into that Arrowhead region, you don't really get any of our other ashes, whereas you move towards central Minnesota, you get some green ash, and then once you move all the way down to the river valley in the southeastern corner, you end up getting white ash as well. And so all three of the species of ash can host this mite, which is pretty unusual. Most gulls are really host specific, where they only like one species, and then they're even more specific where they only like one spot on this host plant species. And so this tiny little mite, the ash flower gull mite, starts out in the winter in the buds. And then as the plant, you know, leafs out and starts to put out tiny little flowers, it makes this Herculean journey because it's absolutely microscopic. Even with your normal microscope, you're not really able to see it. If you want a good picture of it, they generally use like electron microscopes to get nice pictures of these tiny, tiny mites.
No idea and that so they were that small.
Right? And then if you think about that journey that they go on from a bud all the way out to the flower, it's got to be some wildly huge, you know, migration story for them to get from where they're starting to where they're going. It's taken me a couple years because I've also heard that they're only on male ash flowers since they're dioecious trees with two sexes, one male and one female, or they're only on female. And more recently, I've started to decide that they're generally on the females because every once in a while you'll see some of those seeds left over within the huge clumps of what almost look like brown cauliflower or black cauliflower on the upper branches of the tree. But anyways, that tiny little mite crawls all the way out there and begins feeding on the young flowers, which causes them to kind of swell and distort and twist, turning into those cauliflower or broccoli-like shapes. And then they live their whole lives in these little colonies, essentially, out in those ash flower galls, which start in the very beginning of the year as green. And then as we wind into kind of midsummer, when the, I forget exactly what you call the ash seeds, but when the ash seeds start to turn like a light brown, the galls also start to turn brown. And then by late fall, when the ash starts to lose all those seeds and the leaves drop, you get a really dark, like almost black gull as that plant part just ages. And again, that mite goes on another Herculean journey. Generally, it's, you know, a couple generations past, but they go and they find a bud scale back further on the tree and they crawl inside that bud scale. And that's where they overwinter until, you know, the cycle restarts again in the spring.
Wow. That's astonishing. Yeah. I've noticed them for years and years and years, and they are, I had thought that they were on the male trees, but I'm perfectly willing to accept your observations, and I will double down on mine and see if I can find, now that I suspect they're on female trees, I'm going to look at my ash trees and make sure. So now the next one I have is one common one that people see in the summertime a lot, and I get a lot of questions about it. And I don't even know if it's a gall. It might be a fungus for all I know. But you look at a maple leaf and you'll see all of these little projections, all these little spikes that stand up on the leaf. What am I looking at there?
Yeah, and you bring up two great points there. I'm going to touch on first what is a gall, and then I'm going to dive into that specific one you've got pointed out. And so especially like as I got more into it, the definition of gall gets really murky, where there are galls, burls, brooms, and then there are also non-metazoan plant diseases, which is just a fancy way of saying non-insect caused disease, like a fungus. And, you know, as you get into it, some non-metazoan plant diseases have gall in their common name. And not all galls have like fungus in their name. And so it's kind of like a square and a rectangle where, you know, rectangles are their own thing, but squares are technically rectangles, but they're also a special subsect. And so it's kind of funny as you dive deeper and deeper into the gulls, because there isn't a ton of research into it. There's a lot of like fluffy gray area or just a lot of stuff that we don't know about them. And so that's a great point where like the raccoon poop fungus or the black knot fungus on the cherries/prunuses, that's a great example of a non-metazoan plant disease. But it's in the book because it's one of the most common ones people come across.
Yeah, for sure.
To touch on the one you were mentioning on the maples, especially on the sugar maples, they kind of look like little fingers that are sticking out of the leaf and like big clusters, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and some people think that they're kind of fascinating. I found a lot of people really dislike them and they get kind of the creepy crawlies or the ick when they're looking at those. And that form of gull is called a spindle gull or a finger gull. And they're made by another species of mite, completely different family from the mites that cause the ash flower gall mites. And those are called the ash spindle or ash finger gall mites. And pretty similarly, they overwinter in the buds of the maples underneath the bud scale. And in the spring, they crawl on out to the young leaves. And I've seen them on just barely budded out leaves as a tiny little, you know, bump on the leaf. And then as they feed on the plant, each one lives, I guess, singularly, where some gull mites live in big communals. But if you think of like a leaf that has all these finger gulls on it, it's almost like instead of a condo, a bunch of townhouses in the suburbs where each one of those little fingers has a mite living within it. And they feed on the plant, cause it to grow these long spindles out of it. And they're pretty fun when you watch them because they often start pretty green, and then as the leaf changes throughout the year with the phenology of the plant, they also start to turn kind of a little brownish and then end the year at relatively black, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. We're speaking with Sam Guida. Sam has written a new book on brooms, galls. What is it? Get the galls, burls, and brooms. And we are, we'll tell you how to get a copy if you're interested. But before we do that, we need to tell you that we receive support from Brainstorm Bakery, headquarters of Crapola, with four flavors of granola handcrafted at the bakery on East Sheridan Street in Ely. Ordering online available at and more at brainstormbakery.com. Sam, Mark Jacobs has a question for you.
Yes, go for it.
I appreciated your presentation for us at Rice Lake Refuge, and you had implied, like using iNaturalist, that there might be some citizen science opportunities to kind of better document what's out there. Do you elaborate on that a little bit?
Definitely. It was great to be out there at Rice Lake Wildlife Refuge. That was a really fun one. So gulls are a very undescribed and undocumented and, more importantly, unnoticed group of organisms, because as we're walking around, we often overlook them because we look at plants, but we don't look at what's on the plants as often. And so I like to refer to the gulls and et cetera, as stuff on stuff. And when I got started, iNaturalist was actually a really good resource for me because it could save all of my photos and all of my notes. But now as I've been going through and I've been identifying a bunch of stuff that is gull related, it's actually become a really good resource at trying to identify gulls, burls, and brooms. And so if you haven't used iNaturalist before, it's an app or a website. You can download it onto your phone, or you can go to the website on your computer. You can create an account, and then you can upload photos or other sorts of observations, which include like sound bites and videos and that sort of thing. And then it uses like a recognizing software to try to guess what it is that you're looking at. And it gives you recommendations on what's seen locally, as well as to help make sure that these are as accurate as possible. It's got a bit of a social media aspect where other people can go through and they can ID all of your observations. So when people are out, you know, once they're taking pictures of stuff that they're finding on plants, such as all of these gulls, it'll give them suggestions for what it thinks these gulls might be, like the ash flower gull mite, or the black knot, or the willow pinecone gull midge, or the maple spindle gull mites. And so going through all these, it'll recommend for what it thinks that they are and give you a base starting point. At that point, I have created a program that goes through and I've told it to look for any sort of observation of any gull found in the state of Minnesota by, you know, either genus or species name, and it pulls it into one spot into what's called a project in iNaturalist. And either myself or other people can go through that project, and they often do, and they help provide identification of what these gulls, burls, brooms, or other stuff on stuff people are finding is. And it's relatively exciting to go through them and start posting them to iNat as well, because there's a small community that IDs gulls, and I guarantee once you start to look for them, because they're an understudied group, you're going to find species that are unknown and undescribed to science. If you happen to have a quaking aspen in your backyard, or a big tooth aspen, or even a balsam poplar, they're very common trees. They're really, you know, valuable to the state for lumber production. But if you go and check them out, they've got this group of gulls on them that there are almost no described species. There are a whole bunch of them that we know about and they're noted, but they don't actually have a scientific name because they've never been described. And so INAT not only is helping us look for all of these things and learning to ID them, but it's helping to document where they are. And if we're finding undescribed ones, it creates a source that localizes them so people can look through them and learn about them. One of my like favorite interactions through INAT just happened to be with an undescribed species that I found along Lake Superior up at Wolf Ridge. It was this little wasp that was growing on a tall cinquefoil right by Lake Superior, and it seemed to be a pretty small population. And the couple sources I could find on the genus didn't have anything on that host species. And once, you know, I grew the adults out, they were kind of weird and they're really red orangey, where most of the species are black. And I was like, oh, this is pretty wild. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to leave it on INAT. And a couple years later, a researcher at Penn State who's doing his doctorate on that genus reached out and wanted a couple different species. One of that same genus found on a raspberry, some that were found on the thimbleberry of the thimbleberry gall wasp. And then as he was asking about those, I went, okay, you can have those. I'll send them to you, but I'd like you to check out this species because it's really weird. And I sent it to him through that connection through iNaturalist. And he reached back out later and said, can you send more of those? They're really weird. I think they're a new species. And so through that iNaturalist connection, I was able to send more to the researcher. He's in the process describing him. He gave me the opportunity to suggest some potential names, which we've loosely settled on either Diastrus superioris or Diastrus frigidus, meaning found either on Lake Superior or in that frigid microclimate. But I find iNaturalist as a really cool, really helpful resource for not only helping people who are first getting into gulls, but moving into those next intermediate steps.
Sam, we've exhausted our time.
I want to ask Sam one more question. Sam, it had to be great to hear, you know, that students are noticing these gulls. You were a student of phenology and grew up listening to John Latimer. I just wanted to give you just a moment to speak to that and how it led to this curiosity you have about stuff on stuff. I love how you described it.
Phenology was a really important part of my life growing up, and especially with Ken Perry and the Forest View Bird Club. We would always send reports into John, and even before that, growing up, you know, riding into school with my dad and like listening with my mom to KXE, we would always listen to the phenology show because we loved being outside. It was really great to hear what other people were seeing, but also, you know, with the wider phenology network, people would start to notice like, oh, the mulleins are starting to bloom. And you'd go, oh, cool, that's a little further south from us. We should go look for that. And, you know, generally either that day or within a couple days, we'd be able to find all of these species that were starting to bloom due to all of the phenology reports that were coming in. And I found that very impactful, especially later, because it helped to encourage my natural curiosity as a kid and keep me involved in nature and give me kind of like little scavenger hunts to look for. And it's kept rolling. You know, it's really brought me into, I do a lot of naturalist work still. Not quite my day job anymore, but I still love taking people outside and getting them connected to the natural world. And I would really credit it to all of that interaction that I had as a child interacting with all the phenology. Even like when I was working on the book for gulls, no resources noted what the gulls look like throughout the year. And so you might find one that starts green and then ages to brown. And there weren't any notes on the phenology of this because people just weren't looking for it. And so knowing what phenology was and knowing how beneficial it was and knowing all the different like data and resources we can gather from it really helped me not only put that out, but I find it very beneficial and impactful even to this day. And I try to incorporate it into a lot of my teaching.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks so much for joining us. We could talk to you all morning.
Where can we get the book?
Right.
Gulls, Burls, and Brooms of the North Woods.
Yep. Unfortunately, at the moment, it's just self-published. But if you would like to go check it out, I do have a little website going, which is www.gullsburlsandbrooms.wixsite.com/gulls. As well as if you end up just reaching out to gullsburrowsandbrooms@gmail.com, if you're not able to find that site, I can send it to you and you can fill out the form and I can try to get one sent to you. It's getting a little close to get it towards Christmas for, you know, a stocking stuff or that sort of thing, but I'll try to get it there as quickly as possible.
Sounds great. Sam,
I have an autographed copy, probably worth millions.
Thanks, Sam. Well,
I'm waiting on mine. Beat me, Mark.
We got to have you back, Sam. Thank you so
absolutely
much.
Absolutely. Sam, wonderful to speak with you. Good luck and keep on keeping on, man. Keep those eyes open and let us know what the world is doing around you.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be part of a radio program that I listened to as a kid and now get to be part of as an adult.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.